This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we visit with Ashley Decker, a trauma-informed coach, as she tells us what's happening in our bodies and minds when we experience trauma. And speaking of trauma, we don't have to personally experience a traumatic situation for it to damage our psyches. And we are going to visit today with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. He is the host of The Why Show, and he is joining us for our latest installment of the conversation, Philosophical Currents, where we take a deep dive into recent news events from a philosophical perspective. Jack, thanks as always for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Ashley, although our topic today is not, once again, the happiest of topics.
And we are going to be discussing the racially charged events that are happening, of course, across the country, but more regionally in Minneapolis with the recent conviction of former police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd. Jack, as a philosopher, how did you watch that trial?
The thing that I made myself the most aware of was that it felt to me like I was there, but I wasn't. Like virtually everyone, I was watching it on the internet. I was reading things on social network. I was immersed in both my community and someone else's community. So I was trying very hard to be an objective observer, but I also understood that the emotions that I was feeling was not just the emotions that were put forth by the lawyers, by the testimony, by the events themselves, but also the way in which my circle of friends and the news media has framed the issue. And that means that fundamentally my experience of it is very different than the people whom I watch. And I tried very, very hard to be aware of that, although obviously sometimes I didn't succeed.
How do you characterize how the media has framed the issue, and specifically, which sources are you following?
You know, one of the experiences of the internet is that I don't know that I can necessarily answer that question, right? I mean, I look at the Washington Post, I look at the New York Times, I look at the various news sites, but I also just follow links, right? I found out, for example, that this past weekend, the Islamic Cultural Center, the mosque in Morehead, was vandalized. Mm-hmm. And that felt more intimate to me because Morehead is closer and we have some sense of responsibilities. But in another sense, it wasn't more intimate to me because I'm learning it through the same sources, right? So there is this fundamentally weird experience of everything feeling equally intimate and everything feeling equally foreign. And the danger then is that your reactions become about you rather than the source of the information that you're concerned about.
How can we, as responsible news consumers, recognize when our reaction is about us? And I understand what you're saying. When it happens close to home, it's easier to feel more empathetic.
I think the first thing to remember is that when we are expressing our emotions, we're talking about ourselves. So if we have a tweet or a Facebook post that says, I am so angry, or I don't understand, or, you know, I think they've gotten this wrong, then we're not talking about other people. We're talking about ourselves. When we are investigating the circumstances or the ideas and we're asking, is there really systemic racism in our country? What makes people vandalize a mosque? Why would people feel so strongly that they would stand up against the police for something they believe in? This is about them. And so it's not a, I don't know, cut and dry issue here. And it's not always clear. But, you know, social networks especially are designed to call attention to ourselves. And so another question we have to ask is, why are we posting? Are we posting just to emote? Or are we posting to share important information or to learn more? And I don't think there's anything wrong with emoting, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting to share the experience with others. But I do think that especially with very, very difficult issues like this, we want to be careful to make it not about us when it's about other people.
Yeah. How can you do that when it is an in-person kind of event? If somebody is coming down to help clean up at the Islamic Center, or people who took to the streets in Minneapolis or otherwise, and there are signs, you know, sometimes I'm angry or stop doing this, when do we risk the protest being about us versus about the situation at hand?
That's a really interesting question, because I'm going to sound like I'm changing my mind, but I'm not. When you are at the event, it is about you, right? You've shown a level of commitment. You've shown a level of care. If you are going out to the protest, then part of what you're saying is, I'm not the only one who's experiencing injustice, but I'm experiencing injustice. The people I love are experiencing injustice, and I need to express myself. And that's why being present is such an important variable, because again, if we are the victims or the perpetrators of these things, we are involved. But what the internet does is make us feel like we're doing things when we're not. The internet makes us feel like we have a commitment to this task when we don't really. Hitting like or hitting share feels like we're doing something, but we're really not. Going out there, aiding your fellow citizens, taking a stand, this is doing something, and then it does become about you because you've committed yourself to the process in a way that's meaningful.
When it is something that is an injustice, it's obvious that one side is not being impacted as much as another side, or often there's more than one side. Do the people who are not as impacted by police killings, in this case, white people, do we have a responsibility to use that power to draw attention, or are we better off staying out of the way because this isn't our lived experience?
This is one of the great questions of the 21st century. This is a question that divides generations, and this is a question that we as a nation, if not a world, are struggling with. Because, of course, one of the first things that you have to do is listen. If you have a gut reaction to something, you know, it means you have some sort of emotional connection, and that's often good. But that gut reaction isn't necessarily the most informed reaction or the most useful reaction. So the first thing we have to do is listen. And listen, I mean that widely. I mean, read articles, watch videos, engage with a wide range of sources that allow you to, you know, synthesize all those things and make a judgment for yourself. Now, eventually, you are going to have to make that judgment. And you have to recognize that there is certain privileges that you have or certain problems that you face in your life that are going to change that. So, for example, we also have to recognize that we use shorthand language. You use the term white people. Now, that doesn't mean that no white person has ever experienced oppression. And that doesn't mean that there aren't black people who are more privileged than other black people. It's a shorthand that we use to describe issues and the way that our country is organized. So as a white person, we definitely have to not take center stage, but if we learn something that we think is important, that we think is a reliable source, then sure, we could share things. Again, I don't mean to suggest that liking and sharing are things we shouldn't do, but we have to do them with the goal of educating, with the goal of unifying, right? We live in a pluralistic democracy, meaning that we live in a country that has lots of different people with lots of different backgrounds and lots of different commitments and lots of different choices in life. And we're all supposed to work together in some meaningful way. So ask yourself, does the thing you post bring people together or does it divide us? And I don't mean you shouldn't take positions on controversial issues. What I mean is, if you are talking about something that's controversial, that's criticizing someone else, is your contribution constructive or is it destructive? And, you know, in my classes, one of the ways that I talk about constructiveness in the sense is, does it move the conversation forward or does it leave the conversation where it is, or even worse, move it backwards? Lots of information on the internet is useful. I've learned a lot of things from people of all different backgrounds on the internet, but I can almost always tell, I should say, when someone is contributing because they want to really move the inquiry towards a place of knowledge, or where they want attention, where they want to scream and yell. And so, yes, as people who don't experience the same kind of oppression, the very first thing we have to do is listen, read, learn, and only then can we make some judgments that might affect our point of view and share that those judgments with other people.
So in general terms, because we can't go into all of the specifics that this has ever come up, but as you're watching yesterday's 93rd Oscars, there were a number of speeches where people brought up this concept of an over-brutal police force. And these are, of course, from people that I think it's fair to say most of us would consider are very privileged, whether or not they started out that way. Does that help advance the conversation?
Well, with great power comes great responsibility, right? The essential message of our period from Spider-Man. These are people with a tremendous voice. And they have a responsibility to use that voice, but they have a responsibility to use it in a mature and constructive manner. I mean, you and I have more voice than most other people in the region because we're on Prairie Public and we have this tremendous audience. I certainly behave differently behind a microphone than I do in a classroom. And I certainly behave differently in a classroom than I do in private life or on social networks, right? We play different roles. And so if the goal of the celebrities in the Oscars is just to gain coolness points, then I don't think that that's constructive. But if they recognize that there are, I don't know, 40 million people watching them, and that this is a moment in history where, you know, frankly, the Oscars are a little silly. I mean, it's important to them, but it's a little silly and it doesn't really do anything for anybody other than raise their, you know, the fee for the next movie. Then the idea of having the Oscars when all this stuff is going on, it feels frivolous. And I think my guess is that fewer people watch the Oscars this year than in previous years, in part because it's just not as important. So, you know, we do have a responsibility to talk and we do have a responsibility to express our voice. How much power we have helps tell us how we're supposed to express our voice. So for example, President Biden refused to say anything about the Chauvin trial. And he knows that as president, if he says something about the Chauvin trial, it can prejudice the jury, it can inspire violence, it can have an incredible impact that he didn't want to have. His predecessor, President Trump, held a different opinion, right? President Trump thought that he could say anything about anything, and he wanted to inspire that kind of reaction. You and I have a more truncated version of that same thing, right? If you and I are going to say something on Prairie Public, we have to recognize that we're going to influence people, but we're probably not going to influence the jury in Minneapolis. Someone on social network, who are they going to influence? They're going to influence their community. They're going to influence their friends who are perhaps less informed. They're going to risk their interpersonal relationships in a way that may be harmful in the long run to their friendships. And so I do think we all have a responsibility to participate. How careful we have to be about our participation is in direct relationship to how big our audience is and how much power we have.
We're visiting with philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein at the University of North Dakota. Jack, a couple of questions ago, you rightfully called me out on using some shorthand because we can't always get very specific about the group of people that we're talking about, you know, when I said white people. I'm wondering, we use shorthand or oversimplifying all of the time when it comes to social justice issues because we can't, you just can't have a rallying cry. For example, when people say defund the police, what they're saying is reallocating some of the money that's used for law enforcement and diversifying that into maybe some public safety, community support, some social services, having places for the youth to go, having some homelessness services, all things that can cut crime before it happens. But the danger...
That's a lot to put on a poster.
You can't put that on a poster. But are we in danger of oversimplifying it when we say something like defund the police?
Human beings work on shorthand. And I don't think there was anything wrong with you saying the word white. I just think we have to recognize that once we get into it, once we start talking about it, that these terms have baggage, these terms have history, these terms have complexity. So, for example, in a class that I'm teaching this semester, a senior seminar, basically, on citizenship and its challenges, we're talking about how the fact that race doesn't really exist, that race is a social construct. So when we refer to whiteness, what we're really referring to is power, is status, is a certain kind of influence that you don't have if you are a person of color. So we have to recognize that as human beings, we are always talking in shorthand. And so then you have to recognize that the rhetoric is going to change with the audience and with the goal. So, for example, if I am holding a poster and I am marching with people to get attention to the issue or to stand up against oppression, then I can say defund the police. But if I am going to the city council, or I am reaching out to my legislator, or I am writing an op-ed, then I shouldn't use the term defund the police. And this is where the shorthand becomes dangerous in a different way. The opponents of defunding the police keep acting as if what people mean is stop paying the police and get rid of the police. And that's intellectually dishonest. It's politically dishonest, and it accomplishes nothing but divide people. So when you talk in shorthand, you risk being attacked for saying something you don't do. And when you talk in shorthand, you also risk in oversimplifying your own message. But shorthand is a necessary and, frankly, universal entrance into a conversation that then leads to more complexity. And that ultimately, I think, is its virtue, is that it can get us to start someplace that will then lead us to more sophisticated exchanges and for us to learn different people's perspective in with the kind of depth that then becomes useful when we're trying to self-govern in a democracy.
What about when you see a response to Black Lives Matter, the response being All Lives Matter? What does that do to that, again, oversimplified slogan?
Right. So that too is shorthand, right? Because if we take it literally as a logical proposition, Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter are both perfectly compatible propositions. But saying All Lives Matter right now is shorthand for I consider myself a conservative and what I think you're saying is stupid and wrong, right? That's what that means. It doesn't mean all lives matter. It doesn't mean everyone is worthy of universal and equal respect. What it means is shut up, I disagree with you. And so the proper response to that is, okay, but we're talking about Black Lives Matter right now. If I said to you, boy, the World Series is a great thing to watch, and you said, well, what about the Super Bowl? What about NASCAR? You know, I would just think you're kind of a jerk, right? And that's what All Lives Matter comes off as. Now, we have to recognize that there are white people in poverty, that there are white people who have bad experiences with the police, that there are white people who are victims of crime. We have to recognize that, and we have to address that too. But right now, the cultural lens is on this particular topic of Black representation and the way that the police treat Black people, just like at certain times of year, the lens is on the World Series and not the Super Bowl. The world is big. We have lots of time. There's enough opportunity and enough resources to talk about everybody, but we can only talk about everybody, you know, one or two people or one or two groups at a time, because if we talk about everybody at the same time, nobody gets heard and nothing gets done.
When we do focus on the one group that is being more disproportionately impacted, and then you have the splinter, you know, reactions, either way, we're not addressing the underlying cause of any of it, that people who are in poverty, that people who are living lives of crime, that people who have unstable access to food and housing, they might be disproportionately impacted by what you said earlier, systemic racism or just any other kind of life situation. And we're always, it seems to me, just dealing with the head wound. Yes, we need to address that Black Lives Matter and that they are being disproportionately impacted in this specific kind of violence. As a philosopher, what is your next level of, okay, when we can stop addressing the head wound and get to the root cause? What's your hope for that?
I think it's a brilliant question because, in fact, I think that what all of the protesters are saying is exactly what you're asking, right? I think when you see people shout Black Lives Matter or defund the police, what they're really shouting is address the cause, address the cause, address the cause. And I think the last 5 years has been a revival of people trying that in different ways. So you have Colin Kaepernick saying address the cause by kneeling on the football field, and he was kicked out of the NFL for doing that. And then you have people who engage in nonviolent protests saying address the cause, address the cause, and they're told not to do that. And then the frustration becomes so great that a small segment of the population, certainly not the entire population, but a small segment of the population, gets violent because what they want to say is, we keep saying address the cause and you aren't listening to us. And that kind of violence, if you want to understand, this is my personal experience, but I think a lot of people will identify. If you want to understand what it must feel like to be one of those people who are just, you know, throwing a trash can through a window or something, think about what it's like to get to Verizon or your cable company on hold, and they just keep putting you on hold, or they keep ignoring you. I had this mm-hmm. thing the other day where I was trying to fix something with Dell computers, and every time I brought up the issue with an operator, they just hung up on me. And I became enraged.
Right. I'm always angry by the time I get a real person.
That's right. And that, for me, was about replacing a computer plug. You know, my life wasn't in danger. In the worst case scenario, I could drive over to Best Buy and pay an extra $25 or whatever and get the thing, right? But I'm furious. Now, imagine your entire life is being put on hold by the system. Imagine your entire life is being hung up on by the system. The violence, the aggression is a natural, and I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying it's the natural result of saying address the cause, address the cause, address the cause, and everyone only responding and saying, oh, well, you know, you say it's a head wound, but we say it's a shoulder wound, right? And so that's one way that we can use our own experience to enter into the emotion of other people. What happens that makes us so angry? What makes us furious? And how do we react when we're furious? Okay, let's have some empathy for the protesters, even the violent protesters, and say, gosh, what could have happened that has made them so angry and so hostile? And how do we address those causes?
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and the host of the Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life program. He joins us monthly to talk philosophical currents about the biggest news stories of our time from a philosophical perspective. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ashley. It's always a pleasure.
Coming up after the news, we learn about trauma-informed counseling. But now it's time for today's headlines.